Welcome everyone to this bonus episode of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast, where we speak to interesting and knowledgeable people about how best to protect sentient beings from the harms of coming into existence. I'm your host, John, an antinatalist advocate from the UK, and I'll be the main host of the podcast going forward. When we started the planning for our conference last December, Lawrence and I had to decide whether or not to stay on, for want of a better word, safe ground. We could have created an antinatalist conference that just focused on human procreation and tried to avoid any controversy, at least within the antinatalist community, through a narrow selection of topics. Instead, we decided to embrace the potential controversy and go broader, and it's in this vein that we bring you the conference session on one of our most controversial subjects, namely wild animal suffering. Oscar Horta is a moral philosopher at the University of Santiago de Compostela. He has written many books and papers, including his 2022 book, Making a Stand for Animals, and he co-founded the non-profit Animal Ethics in 2012. We reached out to Oscar because we were looking to bring someone on who could speak about one of the most intriguing solutions to the problem of wild animal suffering, namely giving wild animals contraceptives. We were delighted to have Oscar on to speak about the opportunities and challenges of this proposition, and you can check out more of his work with his links in the description. Anyway, without further ado, I bring you this bonus episode of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast with Oscar Horta. Enjoy.
Okay, so welcome to this, the first session of day two for the Antinatalist Advocacy Conference 2023. So I am joined for session four out of the six total sessions by Oscar Horta. So I'm sure he needs no introduction. I'm sure you all know who he is, but I'm going to give a brief one anyway, and then we will get into the role of things. So Oscar is going to be talking about wild animal contraception. Oscar is a moral philosopher in the Department of Philosophy and Anthropology at the University of Santiago de Compostela. I hope I said that correctly. He's written many papers and books on the topic of animal ethics, including his 2022 book, Making a Stand for Animals. But I think that is it. So we can get into things from here. I think Oscar, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can't. I couldn't hear you for some time, but now I can. Yeah.
Okay, cool. I think I was just having a bit of internet issues. Okay, cool. It looks to be back now. Cool. Right. So Oscar, I'll hand over to you to do your thing.
Yeah, okay, well, thanks a lot. So I'm going to speak here about wild animal contraception, but I'll just tackle some of the, as you can see in the slide, the ethical considerations involved. So I'm not going to address the technical issues surrounding this. I'll say just a word about those. And also in presenting this field of wild animal contraception, I'm going to be addressing other issues having to do with how the lives of animals in the wild are and, well, what reasons we have to help them. So, also, sorry, because some of the slides are not going to be, like, nice ones, but, that's how reality is. But, I hope they are, nevertheless, not too awful to watch. Anyway, so the vast majority of the animals that exist are not out there suffering in slaughterhouses and in factory farms or in fish factories. And saying this is saying a great deal already, because there are a lot, really a lot of animals in those places, right? We may be speaking of maybe a number of vertebrates killed often in terrible ways by humans, that maybe like around, say, 2 billion, but then, or 2 trillion, sorry. But then the number of invertebrates that are killed by humans is even higher, maybe 25 trillion, according to some estimates. But when we speak about wild animals, we are talking about maybe potentially a number of 10 to the power of 18, 19, 20. It's like orders of magnitude higher, a way higher number of animals. And their lives, unfortunately, are not that great. They suffer and die prematurely due to a number of reasons, including, for instance, lack of food or water, hostile weather conditions, also disease, parasitism, things like accidents, all kind of deaths, terrible ones. And often, in many cases, it's not just that these animals have these awful deaths. It's also that, they don't have really great lives in addition to the experience of the death. So we can see this in the case of, and again, I'm sorry if this picture is not a nice one to see, but if we consider the fate of an animal like a chick, a small bird that falls from the nest and may agonize to death, suffering from the pain of the injuries, maybe starving to death, maybe being eaten by other animals. So this is not something that happens to a minority of animals, right? There are ways in which we can have a general idea of what may be the levels of well-being that animals have out there by looking at things like, for instance, their population dynamics or their age-specific mortality or their reproductive strategies. Now, why is this so? Well, because by looking at these things, we can find that, there are all kind of different animals with respect to how their numbers vary through time, and also with respect to how old or young they are when they die, or when the majority of them die. And also, we can also look at the way in which they reproduce, that is, how many offspring they have. And if we look at that, we can see some things that are highly relevant for, the kind of evaluation that we can do of how good or bad the lives of these animals are. So what happens is that the vast majority of animals reproduce by having huge numbers of offspring. I mean, if we consider, for instance, some amphibians, they may lay thousands of eggs. If we consider some fish species, they may lay millions of eggs, sometimes hundreds of millions of them. And the fact is that, on average, these animals don't survive to maturity, because otherwise their population would explode. They would grow dramatically in a very short time. What happens, however, is that the vast majority of them die often shortly after coming into existence. And if, for instance, you look at a pond where a frog may have lay her eggs, you come there first and you can see a lot of eggs there. Then you come back a few days later and you'll find that the eggs are no longer there. What you'll find are tadpoles. But the number of tadpoles that are around is, of course, smaller than the number of eggs. And then you come back some days later, and you'll find that the tadpoles are bigger, but their numbers have significantly dwindled because many of them die in the process. And this is not something that happens in the case of a minority of animals. This happens to many animals. I mean, the majority of the animals reproduce in this way, right? By having many offspring. So the fact is that we typically don't think of that. So when we look, for instance, at a picture like this one, what we find is, oh, these cute animals, these nice chicks, these nice ducklings here. And we don't consider that on average, only one of them per parent will make it to maturity, right? And as we said, and as I said before, as we saw, their deaths can be very painful, right? So when animals die and they are very young, what happens is that they don't live long enough for them to have positive experiences, but they have the negative experience of dying, you know, starving to death, being eaten alive, and so on, right? Okay, so in light of this, maybe we can make some guesses about what the well-being distributions in populations may be. Consider, for instance, this table where the horizontal axis represents time and the vertical one, the numbers of animals. That is, for a certain population of animals, how many animals are present there at a given time? So with some animals, it works like this. So what happens is that they have low juvenile mortality. Many of them survive until, you know, they reach a very old age. This is what happens, for instance, in the case of human beings. But cases like this are a minority. These are called type one when it comes to, you know, designing the different survivorship, you know, curves among different animals. Now, type two would be a mixture of type one and type three, but, you know, what we are especially concerned with here is type three, and type three is this. These animals classified in type three, they have very high numbers of animals that die when they're very young. They have very high juvenile mortality. So this is interesting because this fits what we've seen before. The fact that many animals reproduce by having many offspring who die when they are very young. So suppose we made some estimates of what the well-being of animals in these populations may be. Well, there's going to be inequality for sure. I mean, not all animals have the same levels of well-being. Not all lives are equally good or bad. But, you know, these graphs kind of give us a hint of the levels of well-being that there can be in those populations. Because if you die very old, you may expect to have a good life. I mean, not always, but you may. I mean, not always, because you may have some, I don't know, chronic disease or something. Whereas if you die when you are very young, your life is going to be pretty bad. So imagine that we try to, you know, draw some graphic where we represent how good or bad the lives of animals can be. So if we are optimistic concerning how the lives of the animals of type one may be, we may think that, well, the level of well-being may be like the one you see in the left, right? Where the horizontal line represents the zero level at which life starts being net positive or net negative. If we are less optimistic, that means that many animals will have net negative levels. But as you'll recall, only a minority of the animals can fit within type one. The majority of them will fall within type three. And here, if we have an optimistic assessment, we may be relatively uncertain about how many animals have positive levels of well-being and how many of them have net negative ones. But if we are less optimistic, then it may well be the case that the vast majority of them have very bad lives. So this shows that for many animals, coming into existence is no blessing, it's something pretty bad. It also indicates that the lives of animals may vary significantly. So there are animals of certain populations, of certain species, who have much worse lives than others, right? Okay, so once we've seen that, the next point to consider here is the fact that human beings, while often indifferent to what happens to non-human animals, in some cases, they react and they do things that can help animals, right? So there are many different ways in which human beings are helping animals out there in the wild. I mean, wild animals really shouldn't be only considered, I mean, we shouldn't only consider as wild those animals that are maybe out there in, I don't know, national parks or, you know, in the forest or so. There are also wild animals in agricultural areas or urban or suburban areas. And many of these animals, when they are injured, when they are, for instance, sick or when they are orphaned, they may get helped. There are also other initiatives such as rescues of animals when they're affected by extreme weather events or natural disasters. And there may be also, there actually are other initiatives that help very large numbers of animals. So this picture you see here, well, as you can see, it's a small plane. And you see they are manipulating something there. So, well, the things that they are manipulating, they are doses of, they are baits that have doses of a vaccine, in this case, against rabies. And they are throwing them from the air because they want to prevent the spread of this disease among certain animals. The reason why they do this is because they don't want these animals to pass this disease to human beings. However, by doing this, they are helping very significantly the animals that are vaccinated, right? And this is not something new. This has been done for decades already. Since the 80s, you can find scientific papers in journals, addressing this that are more than 40 years old. And these programs, as I say, they have been implemented first with pilot programs, then they have been monitored, and after this monitorization, they have been expanded to other places, and they have not been done only in the case of diseases like rabies. They have also been applied in the case of diseases such as tuberculosis, anthrax, swine fever, and several others. So there is a lot of experience about this already, meaning that we could do more to help these animals. Okay, however, of course, you can think of an objection, right? Which is, what if by helping animals, we do more harm than good? And the best example of this that we can think of is what happens when we feed animals. So in this picture, you can see some manatees that are being fed some lettuce. So what happens when we provide food to animals, but also when we help them in other ways, it's just that feeding them would be the clearest example, is that we can make their numbers grow. So for instance, suppose that there is a population of animals that is starving, you know, and this is bad and we can help them. But if we do this, then we run the risk of, you know, multiplying the population of these animals and make it the case that in the future, they'll suffer a lot. Is there something we can do about this? Well, the fact is that there is something we can do about this, which is combining the program where we are helping animals with contraception. Now, contraception programs have been run already in many different places all around the world. As you can see here in these pictures, this is something that appears in the news every now and then. A clear example of this is what happens in the case of birds who live in towns or cities. And at some point, people decide that, well, you know, they are too numerous. We want to get rid of them and they want to kill them. So an alternative to that, which means that they won't be harmed in this way, is by using contraception. The same thing happens, for instance, with deer, or shall we say deers, because they are not an uncountable mass, even if this is not a standard English, that are also threatened by hunters, because, you know, people think that their numbers are too high. So contraception is a sound alternative to this. And there are many different examples of this. You can see this one. I mean, the ones I presented come from different countries. You can see this one in the case of other animals in the UK. And you can see in the right that the announcement of a conference on fertility controls for wild animals, like boars, right? And it's a conference that took place in a university in Barcelona. And there are other examples of this. So in some cases, contraception is kind of difficult because you need to inject a vaccine, including the contraceptive, to animals. This happens, for instance, in the case of contraception used with large ungulates. But for instance, in the case of other animals, you can administer orally the contraceptive. I mean, you can create some, you know, food products that will contain the vaccine, as you can see here in this picture. So, as we've seen, then this is something that is widely available. This is something that has been done. And this is something that, you know, is backed by science and even by governments. So, for instance, these two, you know, screenshots here come from the British government, right? And from a British governmental agency. And they address two different ways in which animals could be, you know, administered contraception. There are different ways in which this can happen. So, for instance, with large herbivores, typically they are now using a product called Gonacon. In the past, they have been using also PCP. So these products basically prevent the animals from reproducing, but they need to be administered these products every now and then. So it's not like, you know, neutering, right? In some cases, neutering could be used, but it's more costly and so on. But there are other alternatives, at least with some animals, that are relatively cheap, as I mentioned before, just with, you know, feeding them with something that contains the contraception. So why is this important? It's important, first, because it can prevent humans from killing animals. Second, because it can also help us to help the animals, as I mentioned before. We can help the animals with, while at the same time we prevent the bad effects that that could have. And then on top of that, we can also have an impact in, and this may be the most controversial effect that it has, which is that it can make it the case that the animals that are present in certain ecosystems are those that typically have better lives instead of worse lives, which, as we saw, it's actually the case. Not all animals have the same levels of well-being. And as we also saw, many of them are actually not blessed by coming into existence, but, you know, it's just the other way around for them. They suffer very significantly in the process. We do have the support here often of a significant part of the public, also by governmental agencies. And, you know, it's something that is growing. In this website here, you can Google it, you can see how many, you know, cases of interventions like this are taking place around, you know. So that list there that you see is not exhaustive, it's just a screenshot. The list is much longer. And this is something that is continuing to be the object of scientific research. So, for instance, this is a screenshot of a scientific paper that was published just this year, addressing this from a wide perspective, considering different approaches to this. And in this slide here, you can also see a picture from a recent report that was published in the at the Animal Ethics website. Animal Ethics is the organization I work with. In this case, it reviews methods of contraception for wild animals. So all this means that this is a promising way of, you know, helping animals, that much more attention should be paid to it that is paid right now. And also, I want to mention that there may be other things involved, other issues involved here, that many people in the public, from the general public, may be ignorant about, but show other ways in which we can prevent animals from coming into existence that have been actually quite successful in attaining things that don't have to do necessarily with the well-being of animals, but that as a side effect are very positive for the animals themselves. So one example of this, the one that I want to highlight here, is this one that you can see in this slide, the sterile insect technique. Now, what this consists in is what follows. So certain numbers of male insects, mostly mosquitoes, they are bred in captivity and they're sterilizing in captivity. So what happens is that these male mosquitoes, they are then released, and they, well, they have sex with the female mosquitoes, but the eggs that the female mosquitoes lay are not viable ones. So in this way, these populations of animals are reduced. Why is this used? Well, because these mosquitoes may be transmitting very bad diseases like malaria that harm humans or may harm other animals. Is it bad? Is this bad for the animals? Well, not coming into existence. If you are a member of a species like those of many insects, which typically may have lives that are not good, well, it shouldn't be considered something bad. It should be considered something good. So what we are finding here is that we are doing something for the sake of human well-being, but then we are reducing huge amounts of suffering for these animals. And then for other animals, of course, that these animals may affect as well, because they not just pass on diseases to human beings, they also pass them to other animals. And then there are other ways in which, while not being at stake something like what we've seen before, the general idea is kind of related. And this has to do with reforestation plans. So what happens is that when we reforest a certain area, we can make some studies on the ecology there, on what will be the successions of the ecosystems that we expect there to be. And as a result, we can sort of guess that if we plant certain trees, for instance, a certain vegetation, some animals will be there. If we don't do it, then other animals will be there. On the basis of this, we can consider, okay, it's maybe better if the animals that have typically better lives, those who reproduce by having fewer numbers of offspring, are present there. Among the things, they will eat the biomass that otherwise will be eaten by the lives, by animals who typically have bad lives. So that would be good, because by making it the case that some animals are present there, we are going to reduce overall significantly the number of animals that are there. And this is so also, especially because the animals who typically reproduce by having few offspring tend to be animals, this is not always the case, but often their size is much larger than the size of small animals who reproduce by laying many eggs, okay? So this, while not being about contraception itself, shows how an idea similar to the one informing contraception efforts from an ethical viewpoint can have other implications as well. And finally, I'm gonna be finishing soon. I wanna mention that it's very important that we start discussing this and that we start to be concerned about this, not just because of what is happening to animals right now, but also what about, because of what may happen to animals in the future. So you may think that this slide here is about something that looks kind of sci-fi-ish, you know, looks like science fiction, yeah, but it's actually true. And this is about something that happened a few years ago. An Israeli ship tried to land on the moon, and well, it didn't succeed, but it was carrying a certain number of invertebrates, in this case, tardigrades. So there is an increasing number of experiments outside Earth bringing animals there. Moreover, what about panspermia? Panspermia is the, you know, it's the name that is given to efforts to spread life outside Earth. And this life may be, you know, filled with suffering. This was examined by Gary O'Brien in this paper that was published a few years ago. So this shows why it's important to start talking about this. Wild animal contraception or animal contraception in general is important because of its implication right now. But if we get society and if we get the relevant key agents to care about this, so people get familiar with this idea and they start supporting it more and more, this can not only prevent many hours, days, years of suffering right now or in the near future, it may also be extremely influential in order to prevent very bad things happening to non-human beings in the long term, in the far future. So I think it's very important then that we take this seriously as this issue deserves. And that would be it with regards to my presentation. Thanks for listening to this. And I'll be very happy to take any questions that you have about this.
Classic was on mute. Thank you so much for that, Oscar. And we'll have some questions from the audience, but I've got a few to begin with. And actually, this wasn't on my list, but the first thing I wanted to actually ask you about was the last thing you talked about panspermia. And, you know, we're now getting to the point in, humanity's level of technological development where we, you know, it is actually getting to a significant risk, I would say, to frame it negatively, that we may unintentionally or intentionally spread wild animals to other planets, you know, in sometime in the future. How much of a risk do you perceive that as? And are you, I don't know how plugged in you are into the, you know, the people who are sort of working on this sort of stuff, but are you aware of any voices in the groups that are trying to take humans off of Earth that are actually pushing it back against this to try, you know, because they're aware of these risks?
Yeah, well, thanks for that question. That's a very important one, I think. So unfortunately, I'm not aware of any discussion about this, I mean, at least among the people who are willing to do these kind of things, considering the interests of non-human beings. So those who are considering the interests of non-human animals are people who, you know, are involved in animal advocacy, wild animal advocacy, or doing academic work concerning animals, but they are not the ones really dealing with the scientific discussions about this. So that's bad. And yes, there are many different ways in which this could happen. I mean, I just mentioned directed panspermia, or, you know, I also mentioned experiments carried out outside Earth. But, you know, whenever we are sending some probe or some ship out there to space, we are sending microorganisms because they are always contaminated with life. You know, it's virtually impossible to avoid this. Of course, you can say, well, but they are unlikely to be sentient, and if they are microorganisms, and this is correct, But then, you know, they may reach some planet and just remain there and eventually give rise to, you know, some evolutionary process and eventually become sentient beings. So it could happen that humans or the descendants, for whatever reason, they disappear from Earth, but they plant the seeds of sentient life out there that could make it the case that a huge amount of suffering occur that would be totally preventable. And in fact, something that you see is that, you know, discussions about things like panspermia and so on, they typically are very optimistic. They typically think about this thinking, well, it's going to be great. We're going to create life. And this happens because people tend to think that maybe because their lives are going well, or they think that their lives are going well, they tend to think that the lives of everyone else are going equally well. And this is not so. And this is certainly not so for many animals, maybe for the majority of animals, right? So there is a huge risk in this, yeah.
Mm. And bringing it back down to this planet, so you, at the start of your talk, you talked about the sort of total number of animals in the wild, right, and how there's a lot of them. Do you know how changes in human population impact the total number or the amount of wild animals? Do you know if historically the increase in the human population has had a significant impact either way? Do you know in the future maybe how population changes, human population changes, may impact wild animal numbers?
Yeah, so that's a good one. So, well, I mean, it's sometimes argued that human action has reduced the number of wild animals. And it may be that in the last decades, this has happened because of the use of certain chemicals and fishing and so on. It may be that the numbers of the animals that are more numerous, or the sentient animals that are more numerous, that may be arthropods, both on the land and in the oceans, have been reduced. However, this may change with climate change. The reason is this. Let me just. This is an important caveat. All this is very speculative. We don't know for certain. I mean, I'm just speculating. I mean, you can say, well, it's an informed guess, but it's just a guess nevertheless. But there are different factors that we could consider here. So one is that in the oceans, because of the, you know, increase in the temperature of the waters, we can expect that there will be fewer animals, significantly fewer animals, because there are more animals when waters are colder. That's why many animals go to feed in the Arctic or Antarctic oceans, you know? This has to do with the presence of oxygen and so on. Well, we don't need to get into that. And then the coastal areas, as they will be affected, it's possible that there will be fewer animals there, though here it's less clear and so on. But then what happens is that, when you consider continents, when you consider the land, things are different because of the ways in which continents at this point in the Earth history are distributed through the surface of the Earth. So what happens is that right now, there are wide masses of land that are very high north, mainly Siberia and then Alaska and Canada, right? So it is happening already that ecosystems that were in the south, they are colonizing the north progressively. So for instance, beavers are occupying further northern places. So it's very likely then that the number of animals that are present in these land masses will increase very significantly. And especially if this leads to an increase in arthropods, then the number of animals could be much higher. It's true that deserts in other areas, in tropical areas and so on, can expand and all that. So the south of Europe will become more desertic and so on. But then, you know, the north of Russia will become much more habitable. I think it was Putin who said, oh, yeah, climate change is going to be great for Russia. So, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how much research there is about wild animal contraceptive use in marine animals as compared to terrestrial or amphibious animals. Do you know how well contraceptive technology can be used in marine animals, especially those animals that are harder to access, you know, the ones in the deep ocean?
No, I don't know about that. So I haven't read or heard any study about it. That doesn't mean they don't exist. Mm. It's just that, you know, I'm such an ignorant person. But maybe they don't exist. Maybe they don't exist, you know.
I haven't read of it.
Oh, and by the way, just one thing. I didn't quite answer your previous question. I mean, I did answer your question, but I think you were worried about whether by preventing humans from increasing their numbers, we are promoting that the numbers of animals expand, right?
Right.
And I didn't address that directly, though I kind of address it indirectly. Mm. So I wanted to add this. This is like a footnote to my previous response. So it would be hard. It would be very difficult to provide like a yes or no answer to this thing that you didn't answer, that you didn't ask this, but I think this is what you had in your mind. So we don't have a clear answer to that. But there are these considerations to take into account. In addition to the fact, of course, that more humans mean more animals being exploited and so on. Sorry for coming back to the previous question, but I just thought it would be useful.
No, not at all. I suspect that you get this sort of pushback in general when you're talking about intervention in the lives of wild animals, but I think people will be particularly concerned about it when it comes to contraception, which is the idea of the autonomy of the wild animals. I think especially the layperson who maybe, you know, has an idyllic view of nature. So, you know, maybe they need to, you know, see the first part of your presentation to really be understanding the lay of the land. But what do you think the ethics are of use in wild animals when it comes to, as some people may say, the violation of their autonomy?
Yeah, so, well, there are different considerations to be taken, you know, to take into account there. So, first thing, even if, let's suppose that autonomy is something important that we should take into account, and that it is true that we are somehow, you know, violating their autonomy by providing contraception to these animals. Even if these were so, there would be other things that would be very important, such as the huge amount of suffering that will take place if we don't do this, right? This is very significant. We are talking about, you know, suppose that an animal is going to lay, I don't know, 1,000 eggs or 10,000 eggs. We are talking about, on average, 9,000 or 9,900 and something animals who will die probably when they're very young. If it's just 1,000, then it's going to be 990 something. So, you know, at some point, the weight of those interests should count for something, you know. To think that, you know, respecting that right to autonomy, if that right exists, cannot wait, no matter how much suffering and premature death there is, seems to be implausible. And because the figures are so staggering, so huge, it looks like they would outweigh that, right? So that would be one consideration. But then, you know, concerning autonomy, you know, autonomy is important because it allows you to live your life freely. But the thing is that your autonomy can be, you know, frustrated in many different ways. I mean, if you want to lead a happy life, but you can't because you are under huge stresses due to lack of anything, everything or everything you need in order to live well, like you don't have food availability, water availability, and all that. So it would look weird to say, well, I'm autonomous to just die here, you know. And bear in mind also that this is important because when we provide contraceptives to animals, it's not only their descendants that we are helping. We are helping those animals themselves. For instance, suppose they are birds in some urban area. If they reproduce by having many offspring, there will be many more birds, and this will mean that they will have, on average, each bird will have less food, fewer places to take shelter, and so on. So it's better for them not to have more offspring, right? On top of that, as I mentioned before, sometimes contraception may be the only way that can allow us to help them without causing more harm. Meaning that if we don't use contraception, maybe we will decide that we shouldn't have them at all. So it's better for them to be helped and to be provided a contraception, right? So when you consider all these things, it looks like odd to say that, you know, respect for the animal's autonomy should prevent us from saving their very lives, maybe, or crucial elements of the well-being of the very animals whose autonomy we are supposed to be defending, and of many others that will come into existence afterwards.
And what do you think? I think one of them we've already kind of touched on, but what do you think are the unanswered questions that really need to be answered when it comes to population ethics with wild animals?
Well, I think that, well, just to start with, I think that population ethics works with non-human animals just like it works with humans. So I don't think we should accept different principles for humans and for non-human animals. What happens, though, is that in factual terms, the situation of non-human animals and humans is difficult. In fact, to be a bit more accurate, the situation of animals who have very bad lives and animals who, on average, don't have very bad lives, you know, the factual circumstances involved there are very different. And we are within one group. We are among the animals who don't typically have these horrible lives. I mean, even though our lives may be bad enough, right? But yeah, humans, maybe chimpanzees, elephants are the lucky guys, you know? So I think that then in order to answer your question, two different fields remain there to be addressed. One is concerning theoretical population ethics, and another one has to do with the lives of animals, issues related to population dynamics, and so on. So the latter has been addressed already by studies in the science of ecology and you know, life history theory and all that. And what we need is to translate the, you know, the knowledge that has been gained in those fields in terms of well-being, right? In terms of positive or negative welfare for the animals. So when we look at some study saying, okay, well, these animals populations vary in this way and this other way, well, that's some knowledge that if we approach it with the, you know, with the viewpoint of welfare biology or wild animal welfare science, can tell us a lot about how the lives of animals really are. So this work here that would involve, for instance, literature reviews, translating it to the language of well-being would be very, very useful. And when it comes to theoretical population ethics, I think that there is a lot of work there that should be done. And I've been doing some work on this in coming up with models in population axiology and population ethics that are less simplified, less idealized, and include factors such as uncertainty, such as inequality, and also the distinction between the different components of welfare. So it's not enough to say that in a certain population, a net level of well-being is this and that. It would be interesting to see what are the components of that net level of well-being, that is happiness and suffering, you know? Because then if you come up with a model and say, well, you know, it would be good if a population C or Z would exist that would be composed of a very large number of individuals, but well, they would have, if barely, net positive levels of well-being. Well, in practice, if we want to promote that, what we will make it the case is that that's the average, but there will be many individuals who will have net negative levels of well-being and will be suffering a great deal, a huge lot. So I think this kind of work that is more theoretical is also important.
Mm. And what are your, obviously we're at the Antinatalist Advocacy Conference, what are your views generally, or what is your understanding generally of antinatalism, and how do you think, if it does at all, link to wild animals?
Well, so the thing with antinatalism is that it can be approached from many different viewpoints. And if you consider antinatalism as applied for humans, there are certain respects in which it can be good for other sentient beings, in that the number of them that will be harmed by humans will be reduced if there are fewer humans. Some people say, well, but if there are no humans around, the number of animals that will continue to suffer will not go below a certain number because humans will not no longer be there to help them. I can see this argument, but then I can also see how humans can cause a lot of suffering also to animals by multiplying significantly the number of animals that they are around. Imagine, for instance, if all these plans that I mentioned before concerning panspermia do occur. But then also, I don't think that, I think it's very unlikely that people, at least for the time being in the foreseeable future, will not continue to bring other new individuals into existence. So I think that the efforts that you guys are doing may mean that fewer people reproduce. But since some people will continue to reproduce, this objection wouldn't really apply. Of course, there would be other considerations that are maybe just tangential here, such as the fact that maybe if you don't have kids, you will have a lot of money that you would otherwise be using in raising those kids, and you can use them to create a better situation for animals or for anyone else. I mean, you can make the world a better place with that, with those resources. So that would be another factor to take into account. There are many different issues to be considering here.
And for my final question, it's a bit of a double-barreled one. So the first part of it is, for the people watching now, what can they do as individuals to help wild animals? And, you know, if they have a particular interest in contraceptive use in wild animals, I don't know if there is a specific way they can help with that. What can we as individuals do to help? And what are you working on at the moment?
Well, that's not really one question. Those are
I know. It's kind of two, but I tried to
explain it. Unrelated one. Yeah. So I think I'll be able to address the first one only because on the phone I just have a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
And I won't be able to respond to both things in such a short time. But cool. Basically, there are a bunch of things that people can do to help animals and also to promote that contraception is used with animals. So first, they can convince others to join them and to run some campaign to implement this program in a certain area. Maybe, with birds in a certain town or city, maybe with other animals like deer, like maybe hawks and so on, like boars. This is something that has been done. So we need more people, especially we need more animal advocates and more people interested in improving the situation of animals to, you know, support these kind of campaigns. In addition, I think that we should have a long-term approach to these and other problems. So I think that the work that organizations like, for instance, the one I work with, Animal Ethics, are doing is very important. So supporting these organizations, volunteering for them, or maybe donating for them would be extremely important. Also doing things like, helping to spread information about the work they do, helping others to learn about the posts that Animal Ethics or maybe other organizations like Wild Animal Initiative publish, their videos and so on. Well, that would be helpful. I mean, there are many different ways, really, in which you can collaborate with the works others are doing. And if you work in academia, there is a whole lot that you can do researching in these topics, especially if you are in the natural science, if you are in biology, the science of ecology, or veterinary sciences, you could help a great deal. So, lots of things that could be done. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time to address them. I hope to have provided at least some ideas for people to look for more information later. You can visit, as I said, Animal Ethics website. I think that would be it. Thanks for the question and thanks for the other questions as well.
Thank you so much, Oscar. So if there's actually any links that you want to get to people for things that you want to see or ways they can help, we'll be sending out a newsletter. So if you just send those links over to me, I'll include them and people can have them. But I'll definitely include, Animal Ethics. Thank you so much for the presentation and for answering your questions. It was really informative and I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you very much, and good luck with the rest of the conference.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. We'd also be really grateful if you could help us get the word out there by sharing this episode far and wide, as well as giving us a positive rating on whichever platform you're listening to us on. To find out more about AA, including careers advice, donation recommendations, and different ways to have a positive impact, you can go to our website at antinatalistadvocacy.org. To keep up to date with what we're up to, feel free to subscribe to our monthly newsletter and follow us on your favourite social media platforms. Links to all of the above are in the description. As always, we are hoping you will join us in our antinatalist advocacy.